Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Plan Sponsor Compliance Conference Call. For opening remarks, I will turn the call over to Heather Abrego. Please go ahead, Heather.
Great. Thank you so much, Debbie. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Drinker Biddle first ever audiocast for Plan Sponsor Compliance. My name is Heather Abrego. I'm a partner here at Drinker Biddle & Reese, and I'm also here with Summer Connolly, who is also a partner here at Drinker Biddle & Reese. We both basically assist plan sponsors with all aspects of the retirement plans, executive comp, and health and welfare plans. And we thought that this would be a good opportunity for everyone to hear a little bit about, behind the scenes, up-and-coming news, in a little bit of a more informal route versus doing a, webcast where we have slides and so forth. So first of all, let me just get some of the housekeeping things out of the way. Just so everybody knows, we are being recorded. The presentation will be available on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com, and it's going to be under the Insights and Events tab in a couple of days. But just so you know, we'll also email all of you the registrants, people who are also able to attend, with a link to the recording once it's available. Should you have any questions during the audio cast, you can email Mark Kozak, and let me spell that for you. It's M-A-R-C like cat dot Kozak, K-O-Z like zebra, A-K like kangaroo. So it's mark.kozak@dvr.com. So that's if you have any logistical issues, you can't hear us, or you can't understand how to ask a question. We are going to do questions at the end. So without further ado, I guess I have my coffee. I would like to say that Summer does not have coffee with her, so we did lie to say what we talk about over coffee.
Water counts too.
No water. Coffee only. Anyway, I also was trying to find an ERISA joke to input here, something about two ERISA lawyers walking into a bar, but the internet is very, very void of ERISA lawyer jokes. I don't know why, but
we're much more fun than people realize, but
very fun. Our cocktail parties are just immensely popular. So let's get right into it, because I know you all came here to talk and hear, mostly to hear about what's going on. So I thought what we would start with today is just kind of, what is going on? I know, the news has been a little slow, right? No tax reform, but actually there has been a lot of news out there. We do have the tax reform bill in front of us, the House tax bill that was just introduced. I have actually had calls from plan sponsors asking, what do we have to know about it? And especially when the House kind of came back and they wanted the $2,400 cap on deferrals, that was a huge issue for some of the plan sponsors, especially as you all are now approaching open enrollment. So we thought we would kind of talk about what's going on. And again, keep in mind that this is all proposed. So
right. So we always think it's difficult. You've got to do the balance of knowing what's out there. So we've got this House bill that we need to look at, but and so people aren't blindsided and have an idea of what might be happening, but it is still proposed. We understand the House is marking it up, or it's being marked up, and I believe the Senate is also proposing a bill. So this is by no means final, but something that could still be on the horizon to be aware of.
Absolutely. So I'm sure we'll kind of go through it, but again, as Summer said, keep in mind, I mean, this can change. We expect it to change. We will never know what the final is until the final is out there, so just keep this in mind. But I mean, at this point, the current House bill that was introduced basically kind of leaves the 401ks alone. There was some pushback from President Trump, but at this point, they are leaving deferrals the current amount, which is $18,500 for 2018. So we're not going to see any, decrease in the amount of deferrals at this time based on what's been proposed. There's also been some changes on the non-qualified deferred comp plan changes. That we're going to be seeing as well.
Right, so they've made some changes on both the for-profit as well as the tax-exempt side. So they would be essentially for deferred compensation for it would be included in income when it ceases to be subject to a substantial risk of forfeiture. And they've provided that a substantial risk of forfeiture essentially means you need to continue to work. So this is a drastic change from what we'd all been dealing with from a 409A standpoint, so that with respect to compensation for services on or after 1/1/18, the amounts would be included in income when they are essentially are vested. There are some transition rules with respect to amounts that were previously deferred, requiring that they be included in income the later of the the last tax year before 2026, essentially 2025 for a calendar year taxpayer, or when they vest. And so there's also some provisions that allow for plans to be amended to accelerate distribution when they are included in income. There's also changes on the tax-exempt side where the bill currently would be eliminating 457B and 457F plans, again, for services performed on or after 1/1/18. So that could be a drastic change for tax-exempt employers.
I think what's interesting is there's been a lot of media about kind of this whole salary deferral cap on the 401Ks and not a whole lot on the non-qualified. So I think that that's something, especially for our plan sponsors and service providers who work with non-qualified, to really keep an eye on, because I think that's going to be a much more significant change than what was expected on the 401K. So,
and one that probably tends to be a little less controversial. It's a lot easier to tell the general public that you're making changes to the exec's compensation as opposed to the 401K plans that are available for everybody.
True. I guess that's a little more easier for people to swallow. For executives.
Yes.
There's a couple other changes that are under the House bill, and some of them are basically eliminating a couple of exclusions. For example, there's some language about eliminating the income tax exclusions available for educational assistance programs. Currently, it's tax-free up to $5,250 per year. There's also an elimination of the dependent care reimbursement program, so you currently get tax-free up to $5,000. I think that will probably be a big...
And that's a big impact, especially for we have lots of clients who are obviously going through open enrollment or about to be going through open enrollment, and their employees are enrolling in dependent care reimbursement plans for next year. And depending on how things play out, because at least as proposed in the House bill, this would take effect 1/1/18, employers may be in the situation where come December they're going to have to go back to employees and say, that money that you said you wanted to set aside for dependent care, we're not going to be doing that after all. So that might involve some communication issues and explanations to the employees that I think employers are probably not overly thrilled about doing.
Yeah, I mean, I know that I think for all the plans that we draft, especially for wrap plans, you know, dependent care is always something that is widely utilized, so I think that's going to have a pretty big impact. Also, it will eliminate the employee adoption assistance program. So currently there's $13,750 per year that is tax-free for employee adoption assistance. And lastly, there'll be the elimination of the income tax exclusion for employer-paid qualified moving expenses. So these are some pretty significant exclusions and eliminations that I think will have a pretty big impact on a lot of employees out there. So we'll have to kind of see what the Senate comes back with. The House bill also provides for loosening the hardship distribution restrictions under the 401K plan.
Right, it gets rid of the six-month period where you can't make deferrals. It also eliminates the requirement that you exhaust all other loans and expands the type of compensation that could be eligible for hardship. So that could allow for more people to be able to take hardship.
Yeah. And then, of course, it relaxes a few of the non-discrimination testing for the frozen defined benefit plans, which I think the IRS has basically issued some guidance on that in the past. So I think that's, I think all of these things, again, I mean, we'll talk a little bit more about the fact that these are all proposed, you're either on the House bill. We're going to have the Senate come back and work on its own version of legislation. And so we know we're going to see changes. The question is exactly what changes are we going to see.
So keep an eye out there. We fully expect a bill before the end of the year. And assuming it keeps going the way it is, it would be effective 1/1/18 for some of the changes. So keep an eye out and be prepared to address them.
Yep, definitely. All right, so that's kind of what's happening on, as far as the news concerns, the media and the tax bill and tax reform and what we're going to see. So that's a little taste of that, just keeping you ahead of what's out there. For those that don't already know it, the IRS came out with their cost of a living amounts, and they were adjusted. Most of them were adjusted, I think, the casual contributions stayed the same, but for the most part, for most of our plan sponsors, this means updating your notices, getting those out, your safe harbor notices, maybe your SPD. So if you don't know it, it is that time of year. Safe harbor notices, I think, generally have to be out this month. So
yep,
make sure you're on top of those things. And we are including, we don't want to leave out the defined benefit folks out there, so we just want to also mention the fact that the defined benefit mortality tables have been issued by the IRS. So with respect to those actuaries that we have on the call, maybe that one or two actuary that had nothing else to do this morning but listen to us, we want to just kind of mention that, that that's out there, that's going to impact our defined benefit plans and actuarial calculations. Another thing that's kind of been in the news and, you know, what's being talked about right now is, as probably everybody has seen, President Trump has officially announced his intent to nominate Preston Rutledge to be Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Employee Benefit Security Administration. And I think, you know, generally overall, this is probably good news just because he was a senior tax law specialist on the headquarters staff of the Tax Exempt and Government Entities Division of the Internal Revenue Service. So really what this kind of means to us is that we've got somebody that has some experience. Hopefully all of you by now have heard of the name Brad Campbell. He's one of our partners in our Washington, D.C. office. He was also the former Assistant Secretary of Labor for Employee Benefits and former head of the Employee Benefit Security Administration. So like a reporter, I went to him and asked him for a quote about kind of what does this appointment mean with respect to you know, how we're going to see guidance out of the Department of Labor. And so, you know, basically what Brad said was that, you know, we're not going to know exactly what the specific policy priorities are on his personal agenda, but just kind of having him, and actually having probably someone, but having him specifically in place will make a difference on how the agency operates. Currently, there's really, you know, the fiduciary rule, for those that might not have heard about it, there's this thing called the fiduciary
rule. People living under a rock.
maybe you've seen some of our webcasts with Fred Reich and Brad talking about it. But, you know, there's this fiduciary rule. And there's a couple of welfare benefit plan issues that have kind of been subject to some active policy. But there really isn't any political leadership to handle kind of the normal day-to-day issues that, you know, don't need to go to Secretary Acosta. So what we're, you know, seeing right now is that a lot of the advisory opinion requests, some lower-level guidance, and enforcement priorities have all been largely on hold as a result. So we're hoping that this is going to see a change in how that's being handled. We're hoping to see some guidance come out. We also want to mention some good news in that it was reported that Gene Kleinfelter, who's actually an ERISA attorney in private practice, and who was previously in-house at Waste Management and Continental Airlines, has been appointed as Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Employee Benefit Security Administration. The good news with her is, you know, she does not have to be confirmed in the position, and she'll take her position shortly as number two. However, Mr. Rutledge's confirmation process will not be easy. It's not going to be a fast process, and that's probably due mostly to the fiduciary rule. So any nominee is going to face, you know, some sort of contentious process. But he does have the advantage of being known, of having experience, and being a respected colleague. So at this point, Brad kind of mentioned, I mean, you know, not, you know, barring some unforeseen revelation, I mean, he's probably going to make it through the confirmation process. So we're, you know, so it's good news in the sense that he has the experience. You know, he was pension counsel of the Senate Finance Committee. He's knowledgeable both as to the law and the current policy debate. So with him and Gene Kleinfelter, I think that there's going to be some knowledgeable people up there at the DOL that we can hopefully get some guidance issued through. So that's the good news, and I think that is the news desk. Noticing we have a couple other things that we want to mention. You know, I talked about the IRS cost of living, the DB mortality tables. We also had some guidance come out as a result of the hurricanes and the California wildfires. So we just kind of want to mention that there's some relief that was issued by the IRS with respect to expanding the hardship distribution for some of those folks, as well as taking out loans, and that is through January 2018. So for those employers out there that might have employees or businesses in some of the affected states, like Florida, for example, Texas, California, Puerto Rico, you might want to look into that to see if you want to be able to have your participants be able to tap into their account to help with some of that relief.
Right, and it will likely require a plan amendment.
Absolutely, yeah. And I can say that just from practice, I mean, I've maybe had one or two employers come to me and ask to amend the plan, but I think generally overall, it's not
I'm sure they're out there, but I haven't had too many people focused on it at this point either.
So you know what? I'm going to turn it to you, Summer, now. I know there's some stuff going on DB plans and bifurcated amendments.
Right, as we get near the end of the year, and I can't believe it's already almost Thanksgiving and we're down to the wire for 2017, feels like we just started, but it's always the time to think about whether or not there are any required amendments that need to be adopted before the end of the plan year. On the DB side, we've been talking to clients and reviewing their pension plans to find out if they have bifurcated benefits. Essentially, the IRS issued some regulations in 2016 under Code Section 417 regarding actuarial assumptions. And essentially, if your defined benefit plan provides for bifurcated benefits, which would mean that either you have a partial lump sum benefit where somebody can elect part of their benefit in a lump sum and part in an annuity, or if you've got a plan where part of the benefit is actually paid in a lump sum. So, for example, if you've got if the plan required employee contributions and the employee contribution part might be paid in a lump sum, then your plan may need to be amended. And that is an amendment that needs to be done before the end of the calendar year for calendar year plans. That would be by December 31st, 2017. So if you haven't already done so, it's a good time to take a look at your pension plan and see if you offer those types of benefits and if any sort of change to address these regulations is required for your plan. Another issue to consider on plans, and really this goes for all plans, is with respect to disability procedures. The DOL has issued revised claims procedures with respect to disability benefits. It's a little bit of a gray area in the sense that while we have final regs that are supposed to take effect with respect to disability claims for disability benefits that are submitted on or after January 1st, 2018, there is a proposal currently to delay the effective date of that. We don't know yet if that's going to go through or what the delay exactly will be. There's also been some questions as to whether or not there needs to be changes to those disability claims procedures. So exactly when and exactly what may be a little bit open, but it does look like there's going to be changes required. And so this can come have an effect, obviously, on disability plans, but it's important to realize on the retirement plan side that this may also apply to those plans. So, for example, if there's a benefit under a pension plan that is triggered by disability or vesting is triggered by disability or something along those lines, then, and the plan requires a determination then of disability, these claims procedures would apply to that plan as well. Now, there is a distinction to make. Oftentimes, in order to simplify claims procedures and avoid these issues, plans will provide that somebody is disabled under the plan if they are either disabled according to Social Security or if they are determined to be disabled under under an LTD plan of the employer. And if your plan is limited to that, then you don't need to address the DOL's ERISA claims procedures for determining disability. But if, on the other hand, you allow for some determination by the plan administrator as to whether or not disability has occurred, then these disability procedures are going to apply. So as we near the end of the year, even though there's still some kind of open questions regarding how and when the disability procedures will take effect, it's worth taking a look at your plan to determine whether or not you're going to need to address these. And what we've been doing for many clients is amending their plans to essentially provide that the plan will comply with the DOL's disability claims procedures in effect at the time of the disability claim. So that way you can put it in, know it's there, and have the effective date be effective whenever the reg becomes effective, and follow the procedures as they're enacted. So that's something another thing that plan sponsors should be looking at on both their retirement as well as their welfare side.
I think the only time I've ever seen on the retirement side is like a union plan. Like most of the plan documents usually will refer to Social Security or something like that, but I think some of the union plans, because the collective bargaining agreements will go into exactly what is, disability, that seems the creative kind of, where you need that determination. So I would just want to point that out, maybe for some folks out there that have union plans that incorporate the CBAs, that might be something you want to take a look at. Please take a look at.
Right. I mean, you also might want to think about if your plan does provide that you're supposed to make a determination of disability, maybe now's the time to revise that and have it be based under the LTD plan or a Social Security determination just so you don't have to worry about the enhanced claims procedures.
Great. Sounds good. So I think that is all we have from the news desk here at Drink Rebuttal. So I think we wanted to talk a little bit about kind of some of the issues that we're seeing facing our clients. So,
right, so we still see, you know, the 401k and 403b fee litigation continues. You know, this is not, while it's a lot of large plans, it's important to remember that the ERISA fiduciary rules apply to plans of all sizes. There have been some suits brought against small plans, and the DOL can also investigate these issues. So, you know, these continue to go on. People are looking at the issues. Essentially, most of them focus on the costs associated with the plan, making sure that you're monitoring investment options, that sort of thing. One issue that we've seen raised a lot, and I've had several clients talk to me about, is when the fees, like the record-keeping fees, are based on assets under management. So in many of these fee litigation cases, they're saying that that's not reasonable compensation because as fees go up, or as the assets go up in the plan, the fees go up, and you're not necessarily getting additional services for those increased fees. And so those are some of the allegations that are being made in the cases. And I think one thing that's important to realize is having the fee based on assets under management is not inherently a problem. It all comes back to making sure that the committee understands their fiduciary responsibilities and is reviewing and considering the fees and making sure they're reasonable. And so one way to address this issue about whether or not assets under management fees continue to be reasonable is making sure that you are continually reevaluating it. And so going back to your service provider to reassess the fee as plan assets go up and possibly renegotiating the percentage back down to make sure that you're continuing to pay reasonable fees. And all this ties into essentially what we talk to many clients about is making sure that they understand the fiduciary responsibilities with respect to their plans. And so we go to a lot of committee meetings and try to make sure people are understanding that what's really key is that you've gone through fiduciary training and you have a process and that you are documenting that process. And so that means the committee needs to be gathering the information for whether it's deciding on which investment options to offer under the 401k plan or selecting an investment advisor or a record keeper, the committee needs to be gathering all their information. And so they don't need to necessarily pick the cheapest provider or the cheapest fund or the best performing fund. What they really need to do is make sure that they are analyzing all the facts and circumstances and making a prudent decision based on all that information. And then a key component of that is obviously documenting it, because if you've gone through this whole process, but then when you're questioned about it, either in a litigation or a DOL investigation, you've got to be able to prove that you went through that process. And so taking good minutes at the committee meetings is vital to making sure that you can document that the committee did an RFP and considered the various different service providers and discussed it, and based on that discussion, decided to select XYZ service provider, and then reflecting that. And then once you've made that decision, your job's not done. You need to remember to continue and to monitor that decision and make sure that those options and those service providers continue to make sense.
And I think committee minutes, there is such an art to drafting committee minutes. I have seen the gamut from, you know, a regurgitation of every word that was said during the committee minutes, which I highly
not recommend
to do. And then there's the one pager, which basically says we met, we voted, and we left.
Right.
So there's a happy medium between them, and I think it's definitely something that I like to have committees usually select the same person, if possible, the secretary or whoever, be the one drafting it, because there is kind of a process in doing that and how you draft it. So keep that in mind that there, you know, there is definitely a way to do the minutes and not just put it all out there. Well, my favorite topic is Department of Labor investigations. And we thought we would touch a little bit on kind of what we're seeing and where we think some of the Department of Labor investigations. And I hate to always let the Internal Revenue Service off the hook. But to be honest with you, I haven't really seen a lot of IRS audits coming through. I mean, there's been a couple, there's actually been a couple on overfunded DB plans, but it's not something that we're really seeing being very active right now.
I've had a couple, so I think they are still doing them.
But I think, I guess,
large plan, on the large plan, they are definitely focused on that because, in their view, on the large plan audits, they get more bang for their buck because they're investigating a plan that covers more participants. That, you know, is one way that the IRS addresses the issue.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned this, that we didn't have the IRS feel left out of our audio cast. But I, in my practice, a lot of folks are coming to me with DOL investigations. And, you know, it's interesting. They're kind of the type of plans that are getting investigated are all across the board. I mean, we know that there's some, you know, priorities, enforcement priorities and initiatives to DOL issues. One of them being, of course, everybody's favorite, which is the late deposit. That's something that they definitely look at. I just actually came back a week or so ago. I did a presentation at ASDA Annual, and I can tell you that we probably spent 45 minutes with the audience asking questions just about the issue of late deposits. And it is a really big issue. As everybody probably knows, under 5,500, if you have late deposits, you have to actually select the box. And if you don't correct until the following year, you have to select it again. And a lot of times what we'll say to our clients is, well, you know, when you select that box, there should be some explanation somewhere. And I know that it's possible with the ESOL, because I've had other clients do it, to explain that, okay, yes, there were late deposits, but you corrected it, you know, consistent with the voluntary correction program, the BSC program, the Easier Correction Program. Because what happens is if you don't say anything and you just keep submitting these 5,500 with late deposits, you're going to get a letter. You're going to get some sort of, you know, investigation. And I've been seeing, you know, the letters that come out, whether they say limited scope or full scope or whatever it is a full scope investigation. You get a three-page letter with 60-something requests for documents.
The list of things they request always amazes me, how exhaustive it is.
It is
a challenge for our clients oftentimes to pull all that together, and it's a serious time commitment that I find for most of our clients who are, I don't think I've had a client yet where the benefits department is overstaffed. They are generally understaffed and overworked, and so when you add this on top of it, it's always a challenge, I think.
And the years are like, I mean, I just, right now, I'm closing up an investigation where we're doing from 2013 to now, and there was a, you know, we have a change of providers. I mean, it's just absolutely insane, all the information you have to get. And so with respect to, you know, late deposits, yeah, you have that one issue, but the DOL is going to come in and look at everything. So I guess my advice to both my clients, you know, that have to indicate that is correct it, you know, do everything that you're going to do. And if you're not going to go through the Department of Labor's fiduciary correction program, then go ahead and, you know, indicate that you're at least correcting consistent with the program and that you're going to, you know, pay your excise tax, file your 5330, so you have all that evidence should that issue come up. So, you know, like I said, the DOL definitely has initiatives. That's kind of a big one that I'm seeing. They're also looking at fees, interestingly, you know, with, you know, maybe as soon as like maybe 2-3 years ago. I mean, we know 4AB2 came out in 2012. 4AB2 was where the Department of Labor issued regulations wanting more transparency in fees. So they basically said, hey, you know, service providers, you have to start listing your comp and your services. And I know, Summer, we had a blast looking at all those disclosures.
Yes, fun times.
So I think what happened was basically that evolved now into a whole set of questions about fees. And that's something that I think my plan sponsors are not really used to answering questions about. So, you know, one of the things they'll be looking at is, well, how do they determine the fees are reasonable? So I know some of my clients will have benchmarks that they've done. Basically, like what Summer said, I mean, there has to be a process, and the process has to be documented, and it doesn't have to be based on lower fees.
Right, and it does, again, it doesn't have to be the cheapest, but you need to basically be able to justify the fees you're paying based on the services and quantity and quality that you're receiving. And so the fees do are a big issue because that does that has a direct impact on the participants. And so the fees are an issue both on the DOL side as well as in the litigation we've been seeing.
And the DOL looks pretty carefully. I mean, it's not just a matter of, you know, they will ask for the 402 disclosures, they will ask for the participant disclosures, the 404A5 disclosures. They will look at, I actually had a Department of Labor investigator look at the committee minutes because there were some Class A shares. And just as a real quickie for those out there that might not understand what I'm saying with Class A shares, those are retail shares. Normally in a, you know, in a fairly good-sized retirement plan, you will have Class A shares available, but you will also have what's called institutional class shares. So most retirement plans and DOL investigators are used to looking at the, you know, institutional class shares. So with that being said, they want to see, well, what was, if there's a Class A share, I'd have the DOL investigator say, okay, why was this Class A share chosen when it was, you know, there was an institutional class available? And then sometimes, you know, some excuses that sometimes, not excuses, some reasons we'll hear is that, well, we couldn't get into the institutional class share because we didn't have the minimum investment available. And so I actually had in a situation where, well, did you ask the fund whether or not they would waive it for a plan? So there's kind of this idea that Class A shares in this, you know, in this day and age probably is not always going to be most appropriate. So if you do, so if there is a Class A, the DOL is definitely going to want to see why was that Class A chosen, what is the reasoning behind it, and how was that documented. So that's something that I'm seeing, which was surprising because, you know, the mention of it was kind of, it wasn't hidden, but it was, you know, in a set of committee minutes that I was surprised that the DOL actually read.
Well, and that's an issue that the litigators are bringing as well. So I
yeah.
think that's something why it's, you know, in the forefront of the DOL's mind as well.
Absolutely. So definitely fees. During, you know, with every investigation, the process is basically the DOL will ask for all the documents. They will then be doing an interview, one of the fiduciary and one of the kind of your payroll person who's doing kind of the day-to-day plan administration. So with that being said, the fees also is a topic of conversation when they start interviewing. You know, they'll kind of want to know the reasoning. For example, if there was a change of provider, why was there a change of record keeper, let's say, for example, who assisted with respect to the review of the funds and the expenses in the funds. We had a situation where there was, we had a plan sponsor decide to go to all institutional class shares. They just thought that, you know, that was kind of what was being heard, and they had heard that from free litigation, and they thought that was going to be the best thing. It actually turned out, interestingly, that when they look at, and you really have to look very carefully at the fund and see where the expenses are going, because for some of the institutional class shares, the investment manager of the fund was actually getting more money than a class, than a, you know, Class A share. So the idea that you should just go to all institutional class shares is not always the answer. You really have to, and if you don't know about it, the biggest thing we always say is if you don't know about it, go get somebody that can help you. Go get an advisor.
Yeah, I think a key is there's no, it always must be this way. You really need to be considering all the facts and circumstances, and we generally recommend that our committees get help from an independent advisor consultant, whether they're providing non-discretionary investment advice as a 321 advisor, or they're having them manage assets as a 338 investment manager. But, you know, your typical committee is not composed of individuals who are investment experts.
I know.
I'm not, certainly.
So those are kind of the things coming out of the DOL investigation. I am seeing a little bit of the alternative investment idea, you know, coming out. You know, where you've got, you know, quite a few of alternative investments listed. You've got some limited partnerships, some real estate, things like that. That always is kind of ripe for prohibited transaction issues. So if you are have a plan or working with a plan that has those things, just kind of keep that in mind. Going back, though, I mean, and interestingly, on the alternative investments, this is not limited to 401k plans. I actually have a defined benefit plan right now that the Department of Labor is investigating with respect to alternative investments, which
I think there's probably more on the DC side than there are on the DC side.
So I think, you know, I think a lot of people think of DOL investigations for 401k plans, but it's definitely something that, you know, folks with defined benefit plans need to be also looking at. And again, I mean, in this defined benefit plan, you know, and with all my 401k plans, there's always that interview, which I think freaks out every single person that has to do it, because it's very official. They even bring a badge sometimes. So, and one of the first questions that they ask is, what does it mean to be a fiduciary?
Right, and they ask that question, or have you gone through fiduciary training? And so I think it's really important to make sure that you, when you've got a committee, especially when you get new committee members, to make sure that they've gone through some ERISA fiduciary training and understand what their responsibilities are. And then even if you don't have new members, just doing a periodic refresher course to make sure that these issues are kind of first and foremost in the committee's mind.
Yeah, I think that's so important because, you know, as we've seen kind of the evolution of fee issues, you know, it used to be revenue sharing, no problem. Then it became, okay, let's not do revenue sharing, let's do an ERISA expense account. Now it's more about, you know, having the participants do a base flat fee. So it's constantly evolving, and I think committees, you know, there's so many things that they have to look at. I know, you know, I sit on committee meetings all the time, and we could be 3-4 hours just looking at the investments, and some of that stuff kind of goes by the wayside, but it's always good to do at least once a year to just do a quick refresher on what's going on.
And it's a struggle, I think, balancing some of the issues. I was working with a client recently where they were trying to decide how to allocate the fees to participants. That's obviously a fiduciary decision, and there's not necessarily a right or wrong way to do it as long as you've gone through a proper process and determined a reasonable approach. And they were really struggling with, do we charge an asset-based fee, and then you've got, you know, the higher people's accounts are, they can end up paying quite a bit, or do you do a per-participant fee? But then maybe there's some concern that you've got people with a small balance and they're paying a large fee. So it's really sometimes a tough decision and takes some time for the committee to work through and consider their different options and what makes sense for that particular plan.
Absolutely. So that's our DOL update for all of you out there. So those are kind of the things that we're seeing in our clients, basically our plan sponsor clients dealing with. But we don't want to leave out some of our, you know, service, you know, providers that are out here on the call listening to this, and we want to make it relevant. So some of the industry issues that we're seeing, I know that I'm seeing, again, I just attended the AFPA annual conference and helped facilitate a session on 316. I know I also spoke probably 5 years ago at the Western Benefits Conference on 316. And there was not a whole lot of interest in it. People were, you know, they were thinking about it. It just seemed like a huge liability, to be honest with you, 5 years ago. But now as, you know, some of the issues have been resolved and plan sponsors are starting to see that maybe this is a viable. And for those out there, these are third-party administrators who take on the responsibility as the plan administrator. It's called a 316. So they are definitely a fiduciary of the plan, and they take on a lot of the fiduciary responsibilities. The range of services, there's quite a huge gamut. I mean, you could have, they refer to it as light and full 316 administrators. Those that maybe just want to administer, you know, they'll help the plan sponsor do, you know, loans or hardship distributions to a full 316, which is they deal with it from A to Z. They do the payroll. They basically are hands-on. So there's a lot of different issues, you know, insurance issues, bonding issues. You know, how much are you going to charge for this? How much is the plan sponsor willing to pay for it? Definitely those questions are being asked. A lot more folks out there are doing it. I have more, you know, folks coming to me asking, you know, questions about it and really kind of evaluating whether that's something that they want to do. And I'm seeing more wanting to do it. So I think that's something definitely on the horizon for the industry is getting more popular. I know there's some revenue sharing.
Yeah, I know revenue sharing continues to be an issue, and I think some people hear revenue sharing and think it's automatically a bad thing. You know, the DOL has clearly said that revenue sharing is not in and of itself bad, but you obviously need to think through how that revenue sharing is working, how it's being communicated, whether it raises any additional fee issues. And more I'm seeing clients move towards either selecting funds that don't provide revenue sharing or selecting funds that have revenue sharing, but then allocating the revenue sharing back to participants' accounts, and in particular the participants' accounts who generated the revenue sharing, and then just charging a fee as opposed to using the offset, because you end up with a situation sometimes where you can have, depending on the funds that have the revenue sharing, some participants are
bearing more of the cost than others, and so that tends to be where people are going. There's also just, you know, keeping on track with notices. I had a client ask me recently about their annual 480B2 notice, and I think that's kind of a common misconception. So as Heather mentioned before, the 480B2 notice is the notice and the disclosures that a service provider must provide to the fiduciary reasonably in advance of them entering into an arrangement so that the plan fiduciary can understand what the fees are and what the services are and make a prudent decision. And so that's essentially a one-time disclosure that has to be made, and then you have to provide updates if anything changes. The service provider needs to provide additional information, but it's not an annual notice, so to speak, necessarily being provided by the service provider. But it is obviously something that the committee needs to review when they're selecting them and then consider those fees when they're deciding whether or not to continue the relationship and periodically monitoring them. And so this is a little different than the 404A5 notice. Sorry to throw out all these terms, but the participant disclosure that describes the fees and the options and that sort of thing that does need to be provided to participants on an annual basis. And I think there's just oftentimes there's kind of some confusion regarding the two different types of notices.
Yeah, I think some service providers are just sending it out annually, and so I think that's where some of the confusion. So I think what we're going to do is, I know we're right kind of at the mark. We do want to leave it open for questions. So, Debbie, I'll hand this back to you, and we'll kind of open it up for a few questions if folks out there have some.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen on the phone, to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone phone. If you are on a speakerphone, please disengage the mute function before you press star 1. Again, star 1 at this time. We'll pause just a moment. And again, ladies and gentlemen, on the phone, you will hear a voice prompt that will let you know that your line has been opened. Once you hear the prompt, you may state your name and pose your question. And we'll go first today to...
Hello, this is Susan Jennings, and I had a question about the withholding on hurricane-related distributions. We know it's not 20%, but we were wondering if we were required to do a mandatory 10% withholding on a distribution from 403B or 457 plans.
I think so, but I honestly, I would have to go back and double check the notice on how the withholding works. If you want to email Mark your information, we can circle back with you and follow up on the specifics on that for you.
Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, star 1. We'll take our next caller.
While we're waiting, I did get a question. I had an interesting question the other day, getting back to the topic that we had about minutes, where we had a client asking whether or not they should be recording who on the committee voted what when they were taking views. And, you know, we talked actually amongst ourselves, and the consensus was that really is not appropriate necessarily to document who voted what, rather what's really important. And I think this gets back to what Heather was saying as far as walking that fine line. So you want to document that there was a discussion about the issues and the committee reviewed the information, they discussed the information, and then set out what the actual decision was is a better approach, we think, than actually saying, you know, Joe voted yes and Bob voted no and Michelle voted, I don't know. Michelle was sleeping. We woke her up and she said, whatever you guys want to do. Well, I think that actually brings us to unfortunately, that brings us to time. So as you mentioned, if you have questions, feel free to email Mark, and we can circle back with you on that. But, Debbie, I will go ahead and pass it back to you. And thank you, everybody, from Summer and I. We plan to do this in the future. So thank you for attending, and hopefully we will do these.
Yep. And please feel free to, when you email Mark, if you have additional suggestions on what might be specific topics or additional changes as we kind of start this process of doing these periodic audio casts, we'd appreciate your input. Thank you.
Oh, and if you have a wicked joke, send it to us because I can't find any. So we want to get a little
exact
collection of those. All right, Debbie, back to you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's conference.